Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Liberian peace activist Lema Bowie was one of three women awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Bowie spoke at a recent launch event for the film series, telling her story of survival, revolution, and victory.
I had two babies, heavily pregnant, and I walked 5 hours to my parents' house. Is that what victims do? No. We are fighters, survivors, not victims.
Joining us now to talk about the series and the women like Bowie profiled in it is Abigail Disney. She's one of the creators and executive producers of the five-part PBS series Women, War, and Peace. Abigail has devoted her career to producing films about various social issues, including Family Affair, Playground, Sun Come Up. It was an Academy Award nominee in the 2011 for Best Documentary Short, and Return. And she's involved in several more films in various stages of development. She also was a producer of the film Pray the Devil, Back to Hell, and writer on Peace Unveiled, the second and third segments in the series about Liberia and Afghanistan, respectively. She's talking to us today from New York. Welcome to the show, Abigail.
Thank you.
So two Nobel Peace Prize winners, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Liberian peace activist Lema Bowie, in particular, are profiled in the second part of the series. And part of this story, one writer said that they have... Well, one writer writing about them said that both of them have forever transformed the image of Liberia from a pariah nation of warlords and gunslinging, drug-induced child soldiers to a country on its way back to civility and normality. And I have to say, I really did not understand what was going on there until I saw it through the lens of what the women did.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very much the project of the whole Women, War, and Peace series is how transformative it is and how enlightening it is to just, you know, look at the war through a woman's eyes.
Which historically very rarely is ever done.
Well, pretty much never. You know, it certainly hasn't been done in a sustained, you know, and very rigorous way, the way we're doing it in Women, War, and Peace. And it certainly isn't the way we talk about war in fiction and you know, poetry and movies and video games. We never see it through the eyes of the women involved.
And in a way, I mean, modern warfare is much different than it used to be, too. Women are much more involved now.
Yeah, they're really more at the center, in part because war has changed since the end of the Cold War. You know, we had we are having fewer conflicts, which is the good news, and fewer deaths around the world due to conflict, which is also good news. But wars have more often been between civil ethnic actors and for land, and they're more often civil wars. Or low-temperature conflicts that never even actually get acknowledged as official conflicts. And that brings pressure on civilians. When you're fighting for instance, a drug trafficking route, as you might be in Colombia, what you're most interested in doing is controlling the civilian population or just pushing the whole civilian population off their land. And so you're either displacing or terrorizing civilians. And when you say civilians, what you really mean is a large percentage of them, either women or with the people who rely on women to get their food, to get their water, to have their communities.
Elderly and children.
Yes.
My guest is Abigail Disney. She's one of the creators and executive producers of the five-part PBS series Women, War, and Peace. And yet, Abigail, the phrase rape and pillage has been around forever. And that was another thing that kind of, you know, slapped me across the face was, oh, my gosh, we've all kind of thrown that phrase around like it's kind of very benignly.
Yeah, it really does. And it's an important thing to, you know, take that out and have a good long look at it again for two reasons. One is that it has always been the presumption, and it used to be more overtly stated, that rape was sort of the privilege of the victor. It was one of the things you were rewarded with as an army. But the other thing is that we have always written about war. If you look at, say, the Iliad, you know, or the Charge of the Light Brigade, or any of the World War I novels, and then all of our war movies like Rambo and so forth. We just don't see the women there. They're just nowhere to be seen. And so it has created this impression that war is like a football game and there are sidelines and there's this place where they do their thing and then, you know, and we even use language like collateral damage, which implies like a physical separation between the women and the action. So we've always underestimated the role women play and how central they are in all of this, you know, and then on top of that, it's shifted in the last 50 years.
And so by de-emphasizing it, really what you're doing is you're dehumanizing.
I think that's right. And I think that's one of the reasons that we don't see women in, say, a film like Rambo, because you can't have this kind of mystical glow around your, you know, incredibly heroic figure if, in fact, you really see it through a civilian's eyes. You know, if you look at it through a woman's eyes, Rambo starts to look laughable and ridiculous and, you know, certainly not a way to solve social problems and, you know, certainly not the smartest way to go about the business of making peace.
In the segment, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, it's the inspiring story, as we mentioned, of the Liberian women who took on the warlords and the regime of dictator Charles Taylor in the middle of that horrible civil war and achieved really a once unimaginable peace for the country in 2003.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing how they did it the old-fashioned, nonviolent way.
Exactly. They did. They did. And I mean, I think it's really important that they made a lot of choices that were really smart and strategic. They brought together the Christian women and the Muslim women, which was difficult. They'd never worked before, so they had to kind of work out their differences first. They really kind of took a stand that was sort of above the particulars of the political disputes and really just said, first, you got to put your weapons down, then we can talk about the politics. So that was really smart, because then they couldn't be divided on political lines or accused of being, you know, kind of in the tank for one or the other. And then they just simply never stopped saying it. You know, they never lost patience. They sat on a field. They insisted on the authority of this argument, you know, and they prayed and they fasted and they sang. And they really, they kind of spoke as mothers. And I think it was that, the insistence on nonviolence and in speaking in the voice of a mother that kind of, in a way, it sort of slices through all the normal cynicism that we bring with us when we talk about politics and made everybody kind of remember who they were.
It was. It made me, when you're, lots of footage from the war, amazing footage that you've seen bits and pieces of over the time, but nothing like I saw that like we did in Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And it made me remember and realize every single one of those little boys out there with a gun had a mother.
Exactly. It's really, it's when you think of it that way, it really is difficult to kind of conceive of what would drive a warlord or a general to build an army like that and to sustain it and to keep using it pretty much for personal gain. It's almost impossible to believe. But there it was, and it was sustained for years and years and years until these women really kind of put their foot down and said enough.
Well, and then they got him to Ghana, right? That's where they were doing the peace talks, such as they were. And they were supposed to take 2 weeks, and they ended up 6 weeks later. All these guys, because they're all men, are getting into having a party.
Yeah, basically. So here are these guys who are shooting at each other, having sodas together in by a nicely, you know, clean and beautiful swimming pool, while in the middle of the peace talks, some of them are on their cell phones ordering mortar fire into the city to position themselves better for, say, the finance minister. It was hideous, as many peace talks are, you know, because generally they're populated by the people who shot their way into the room. So there's always an enormous amount of cynicism around peace talks, and it really did sort of break everyone's heart among the women. I mean, you see them at one point just crying and singing and praying because of the despair. And that was when the leader, Lema Bowie, the Nobel Prize winner, kind of said, okay, well, this is enough. And she orders the women to surround the building and lock arms, and they send a note inside saying, we're taking you all hostage
right.
for the women of Liberia.
And they physically do block them.
They physically took the guys hostage. Actually, it's not in the film, but one of the things Lema told me was, almost immediately, all the men had to pee. They had to go to the bathroom right away. They were like,
that
he said
the
they were exactly like my son.
You know? you know, tell us a little. One thing I did hunger a little bit for was Lema Bowie is incredibly intelligent.
Yeah.
I mean, just native. I mean, that at the gut intelligence and beautifully well spoken.
Yeah.
Tell us about her. Where did she come from?
She's a really interesting woman, and I should say she also just published her memoir too.
Right.
Which is called Mighty Be Our Powers. And it's at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And it's a pretty amazing story. This is why I urged her to write the book, because much of that's not in the film. She came up, you know, kind of nice middle-class family, wanted to be a doctor. She graduated from high school, and literally the day she graduated from high school, the war hit Monrovia. And she kind of spiraled downward because she thought, well, you know, if a bullet could end it all, you know, in a second, why would I do anything? And she kind of went off and got into a terrible relationship with an awful guy, had four children by him, was in and out of refugee camps, was being abused by him. When finally a woman said to her, you know, you might, you know, want to try a job. And she took a job and studied to become a social worker so she could do trauma counseling for some of the women who were coming out of the conflict zones. And that just altered her completely. Not because of the way these women were victimized, although that was, you know, certainly a piece of it, but also their resiliency kind of it just revolutionized the way she thought about women and what women were capable of.
Which comes out in that quote that we had at the top.
Right.
That
exactly.
If this is what a victim is.
Exactly.
We are not victims.
Exactly. And that kind of led her to start working with the boys who were coming out of the armies. And she started realizing that they'd been victimized, too, and that you couldn't talk about this conflict without understanding the enormous pain and trauma suffered by all parties to it. And the way that war just absolutely devours the entire culture. You know, when we talk about war, we are often, what we're referring to really is combat. And combat is a small subset of a larger thing, which is war. And war is big. It's starvation and displacement and destruction of the infrastructure and the healthcare systems and so forth. It's more than just, you know, the moments in which the people are shooting at each other. And if you understand war in that way, you really start to understand why it is that women are right at the center of it.
My guest is Abigail Disney. She is executive producer of PBS documentary series Women, War, and Peace. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page as well, and you can tweet me at @AnnFisherWOSU. We look forward to your questions and comments. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Under the agreement, the Blue Jackets will not owe nationwide rent. The deal's creators say this will help the financially struggling franchise, but the team already has enjoyed a similar benefit. The Blue Jackets have not paid rent in 4 years, totaling $12 million. Plus,
hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and be sure to watch Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel will provide a preview of the November 8th election. Tune in for Columbus on the Record. It's tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation announcing the Big Give, when all online gifts to 600 nonprofits will be matched by Columbus Foundation donors for 24 hours beginning 11 a.m. November 10th. More at columbusfoundation.org.
48 degrees with sunny skies in downtown Columbus. Sunshine throughout the day and warming up to a high of 55 degrees. Clear skies tonight and chilly, a low of 31. More sunshine for Saturday and a high of 55. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about women and war with Abigail Disney. She's one of the creators and executive producers of the five-part PBS series, Women, War, and Peace. Abigail, you also show how women are emerging as necessary partners in brokering lasting peace and what they mean to lasting peace and as leaders in forging new international laws and governing conflict. And that really came out in the first program in the series, I Came to Testify.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bosnia is really kind of the story, if you look at Bosnia today, of what happens when there's systemic impunity, because, you know, there was massive amount of rape and sexual violence during the conflict. It was defined by that in many ways. And, you know, the women in Bosnia were the first to speak it, you know. So this had happened in many conflicts before, but what had happened was women just would not speak on the subject, so that in the time afterwards, there was no expectation that people be held responsible for what they did. And, you know, it reinforced this idea that, you know, rape is just sort of inevitable. They can't really help themselves. Boys will be boys, et cetera. And so these women kind of really did this courageous thing by coming and testifying in the International Criminal Tribunal. And the precedents that were set in those courts, in those trials, particularly the one that we cover, mm-hmm. are precedents that are being used today in other conflicts around the world.
They actually talked about the rape issue during the Nuremberg trials, which was surprising information.
Well, they didn't talk during the Nuremberg trials. No. They talked in advance of the Nuremberg trials. They had a conversation about whether or not rape should be charged.
Right.
And there was massive amount of rape in that war, both of women in the Holocaust, which is still not spoken, as well as of German women when the Soviets took Germany over on the east side. So there was a conversation about that. And one of the cables that came from a French diplomat said, well, you know, we can't really discuss that because it would be too distasteful to discuss at Nuremberg. That word distasteful really knocks my socks off, you know,
as opposed to everything else.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, one of the things that's changed, and that's one of the things we emphasize in this, is that women have moved up through the ranks of investigators and prosecutors and magistrates and judges and so forth. So the women who chose to speak also had, first of all, allies among the activists around the world, allies among the journalists who took the charges seriously rather than just, again, dismissing them as a boys will be boys problem. And then they had people inside of the national system or the international system who took the charges seriously and understood that this was worthy of prosecution. So that's an enormous shift in 50 years, an enormous shift. And we need to stop and really appreciate that this is a big difference. We're at a different moment now.
How much of that had to do with the fact that they were women who prosecuted?
I think a lot had to do with it. And I think it's one of those things where, the people at Nuremberg didn't not prosecute because they were bad people. I think they just really didn't feel the gravity of the rape because they hadn't experienced it and couldn't imagine it. And, you know, there's just something about being a woman and seeing another woman and really getting it about the way her life has been absolutely transformed by this trauma and this victimization. So they just needed fellow travelers inside of the system who said, no, actually, this really is serious. And they needed people who had enough power, you know, to be able to assert that.
And also, it really got at the heart of the issue of rape as a political act of violence, not just, raping and pillaging kind of a thing casually, but to demoralize and dehumanize the enemy.
Right, exactly. And that was the strategy. And it was a strategy that was very overt on the Serbian side. You know, they had conversations, and there are documents that say, well, if you think you want to destroy a Muslim community, this is how you do it. You go and you rape the women, because if you rape the women, they'll be cast out. If you keep them till they're pregnant to term and can't but deliver these children, you leave these little Serbian time bombs in this community to further destroy and demoralize. And, of course, it demoralizes the men. So it's an attack on the whole family structure. It's an attack on any ability this community will have to recover from the conflict.
My guest is Abigail Disney. She's one of the creators and executive producers of the five-part PBS series Women, War, and Peace on WOSU-TV. If you have a question or comment for her about women and war, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. One of the ways in that trial was interesting that they managed to protect the 16 women who did speak about the crimes in Bosnia was that they were allowed to cover their faces, and you couldn't see their faces on television, and you couldn't even hear their voices.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that was one of the difficulties, obviously, for us in making the film. We couldn't really show most of the people to whom this had all happened. But it was ironic, and it really added to the trauma for these women that actually the only people who could see their faces were the people they were accusing. It was kind of an upside-down way of going about it. But it really also kind of took a lot of the emotional impact out of the trial for people who were looking to have a kind of an emotional catharsis. And it was really a very difficult aspect of the whole thing.
Lots of people avoid these kinds of shows because they think they're going to be depressing. And I have to say that I was sad, but not depressed. And I was moved.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that's a little what we're going for. Because, you know, there is this kind of tendency to avoid anything, you know, that really has gravity. And I
say, Abigail, are you moving around? Are you on a digital phone?
I'm on just my cordless phone.
Okay. For some reason, it started going wicky-wacky on us, but you sound good now.
Okay.
So anyways.
So that's what we're going for. To me, like, if I watch the news only, I do get pretty depressed. But there's all this good news out there in the world, and it's not necessarily how things come out. It's what people do and what people are capable of, and what kind of people are out there, these non-victim victims, as Lema calls them. And I feel like that's the news I want to bring to Americans, because just never see it. You just never see depictions of these extraordinary women that I get to meet in my work all the time. And they help me go on. They make it possible for me to know this stuff and still get out of bed every morning and do what I need to do.
I have to say, I interviewed a poet from Liberia about a year ago, and this just casts a whole different light on it. It was a fabulous conversation, but it's very different when you see what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
It took me a while to sort of get over my first trip to Liberia, because I had never really come face-to-face with the kind of cruelty and systematic sadism that I came into contact with. It's just your whole sense of human nature, and that's why it's important to spend some time thinking about the people that we're showing you in these films, because they'll shift your sense of human nature yet further. Yes, we're capable of great horror, but we're also capable of enormous bravery and ingenuity, and, you know, that's what I need. That's the corrective dose.
How did this series occur to you?
Well, you know, Ginny Rediker, who directed Pray the Devil Back to Hell, and I were having this kind of conversation the whole time we were making the Liberia film, because of the difficulty. It was very interesting. That footage, which is very compelling about that combat footage, was actually rather easy to come by from archives. There's tons of it. and that's because it's kind of a little sexy, you know, to shoot this footage of people shooting at each other and boys with guns and so forth. What we couldn't find was footage of the women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was almost impossible to find it. And that really struck us as an interesting notion, because that meant that no one considered this to be a story. No one considered this to rise to the level at which we were supposed to notice it. And why was that? And simultaneous with that, Ginny was having also a conversation with Pamela Hogan, who's our third producer, and who produced for WNET for many years. And eventually the three of us all came together and started talking about what it was about this invisibility that we wanted to address. First of all, there was a lot of stories that hadn't been told. Second of all, the point of view of these women really altered your sense of the whole phenomenon of war. And then, you know, there was just this really corrective thing that had to happen. We had to start the ball rolling in this direction of really trying to get our media to notice and to focus on these really important and transformative points of view.
I think Bowie said it this way. She said, the prize is a recognition that global peace can only be achieved if women's needs, concerns, aspirations, and skills are utilized and maximized.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's absolutely, it would have been impossible for Liberia to resolve its problems without the women.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Kind of scary.
It was the women who really brought everybody back to their senses. But beyond that also, there's this really important thing that happens after the conflict, because, you know, whether or not they get credit for it, in almost every conflict, they're the first ones when everybody's coming back to their villages, when everybody's coming back to their towns, of thinking about, okay, well, now how are we going to get water back? Where are we going to go for the firewood? Who's going to live where? What are we going to do with the kids? Where's the school going to be? They rebuild. That's their impulse. And it's not because, and I keep telling people this, this is not that estrogen is magic juice. It's not magic juice.
The nesting and right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What we know, and from millennia of human history, we know for certain is that every culture has women doing that job of finding the firewood and getting the water and feeding and clothing and housing and caring for the sick and so forth. And peace is just the necessary precondition for them to succeed at the job. So whether it's biological or evolutionary, I kind of don't care. It doesn't matter. But what matters is we have these millennia of history to show us that women know where the water is. Women know what the order of priorities is. Often they know where the guns are and who the troublemakers are. And so the fact that we consistently and almost willfully ignore them just dooms us to failing again and again. 85% of peace agreements end in 5 years in failure. So the conflict re-erupts. And only 3% of signatories to peace agreements around the world are women. So I think these two facts have to be linked. Because if you don't include women in not only in the discussion about how to stop the conflict, but how to move on differently and address the root causes of the conflict, you're just going to find yourself back at the same spot you were in when the war broke out.
And, of course, Liberia took it a step further and elected a woman president.
They did. They did. And she... you know, she's being up for re-election today. In fact.
Exactly.
Yes. And, you know, she's been a really transformative leader there. She's not perfect. And electing a woman is never the recipe for the Eden descending and everything being just fine. But she has proven herself to place the priority of her political leadership on the things that women demand when they step up, like employment, like schools, like clean water and housing and electricity, and not on building the army up, arming the militias, and the kinds of things that men, and this is something that you can go find studies that show that there's a statistical difference in the way women tend to spend money when they're elected to office, so that the money has been deployed, there's been less corruption under her, although there's still corruption, and she's been able to move the economy forward.
I'm speaking with Abigail Disney, one of the creators and executive producers of the 5-part PBS series Women, War, and Peace. If you'd like to speak with Abigail, have a question for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hey, have you heard car talk lately?
How can I delicately say this?
You can't.
If I wanted to unleash an odor of my own, right, the time to do it is when you've encountered some other odor that might mask your odor.
Good point.
Right? And of course, you'd open the window just to be on the safe side.
For more well-reasoned car advice, join us this week for Car Talk.
And Car Talk is tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here with All Sides in 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend with host Marilyn Smith for a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. That's All Sides Weekend at 11 o'clock.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
Narrated by Steve Martin, a banjoist himself, PBS Arts' Give Me the Banjo explores the roots of American music, from the minstrel show to ragtime to jazz, blues, folk, bluegrass, and country. It's a story of America's quintessential musical instrument, from its African slavery roots to today. The show features performances from Pete Seeger, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and more. Watch PBS Arts from the Blue Ridge Mountains. Give Me the Banjo, tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. Sunny skies for today, a high of 55 degrees this afternoon. Clear skies tonight, a low of 31. More sunshine for Saturday and a high of 55. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Abigail Disney. She's one of the creators and executive producers of the five-part PBS series Women, War, and Peace on WOSU-TV. You can learn more about it, and you can also get to a link on the Women, War, and Peace website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about it. If you'd like to speak with Abigail, you're welcome. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Getting back to the watchability. You know, many people are going to say, this is happening somewhere else in the United States. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't do this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. And I do think Lema said something really powerful just last week when she was at a press conference. She said, you know, if you sit back and assume that the world's problems are not your problems, eventually they'll find their way to your doorstep. And I thought that was kind of an amazing observation. The world's problems are our problems. And, you know, Lema, I think of as, you know, she might as well be my sister. She's so similar to me. And that's one of the powers of doing this kind of programming is finding yourself in people you thought were incredibly different. And that's always really a very lightning, empowering moment when you realize that people in Bosnia, people in Liberia are not all that different from you and me.
When you spent about 3 years producing this?
About three, almost four, actually.
And interviewing all of these women?
Yes, yes.
What's that like to meet women like this?
You know, I'm just really blessed in my life. I'm so lucky to be able to say, well, this person, I met her, she's amazing, she's my friend. I mean, I don't know why I got that lucky, but knowing a woman like Lema, meeting these women like Hasina Safi and Shinkai Karakal from Afghanistan, who, you know, get death threats every single day, and still they have a sense of humor. I mean, that's one of the things that's really great about
yes.
them is they're funny, they're really smart. They're the same everywhere. They start every meeting with food. This is a woman thing,
mm-hmm.
and they're fighting a lot of the same problems. You'd be amazed at the way you can get a room full of Haitians and Sudanese and Cambodians and people from Tbilisi, Georgia and Chechnya together, and then they'll basically have more in common than not when they talk about certain issues. And that's very powerful. I mean, to sit in an edit room and to hear a Colombian woman use almost identical vocabulary for what it feels like personally to be a displaced person to a woman from Afghanistan, that is an incredible moment, really incredible.
I want to get to the Afghanistan show, but first I wanted to talk about something that I noticed in the Bosnian episode. Mm-hmm. It was all women and one man talking.
Yeah.
And he was a journalist who had left Bosnia many years beforehand and grew up in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that afterwards. I'm like, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
That's except, you know, what little you heard during the trial. But
yeah, yeah. Well, it's important to us. We wanted to have women's voices because we don't have a lot of women's voices.
Mm-hmm.
especially on the subject of war. So it's sort of like a corrective measure. But I have to say, that's the episode we asked Matt Damon to narrate, for also for a very important reason. And that is that, you know, I've spent a lot of years hearing from women about the gravity and importance of sexual violence and hearing their voices and the indignation in their voices on behalf of other women. And I just haven't heard enough men's voices indignant and horrified and frustrated and angry about the victimization of women in this way. And I just really think it's time for men to start stepping up and challenging each other. And so I wanted Matt Damon to kind of constitute an invitation, you know, to other men to say, no, this does disgust and horrify me, and it is really wrong, and I don't consider it to be natural or inevitable in any way.
And there's an interview with Matt on the website.
Yeah, he did a wonderful interview for us. He's such a sweetie. And by the way, everybody who worked on the series for some reason had to show up that day. That was interesting. There were like 65 people jammed in this tiny little sound recording studio. But he was really sweet, gave us some extra time, and we did this interview with him. And I wanted him to just verbalize this thing about, you know, why is it that when you do something that's really important, we're talking about war, this is, you know, a central defining social problem that everybody should care about. But if you put women in the title next to that, suddenly it's the presumption is only women care. And I know that's not true. That's not my experience of the men in my life. And I wanted to be sure that Matt could find a way for some language for that. Why should men care? And he just hit it out of the park. He was great.
As the father of four girls.
Yes, exactly.
The third program takes place in Afghanistan. It's a place that we're still engaged with now. It was back in 2009. It's called Peace Unveiled, and it follows three Afghan women who risk their lives and still do every day to protect women's rights. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, that was a really interesting film to make because Afghanistan is, you know, there's constant developments in the processes there and in the war there. And just 2 weeks ago, Burhanuddin Rabbani was assassinated, was the head of the High Peace Council. He features in our film in a bunch of different places. And so there's always developments. It's always changing. But in some ways, it's just sort of always the same. And it never changes. And what these women are confronting in terms of the slipperiness of their progress, the way that every victory they have also has a little bit of defeat coloring it at the same time. There's just no certainty about the way forward. But looking back in hindsight, boy, is there certainty about the mistakes we've made along the way. It's a really challenging, important story to tell. It's full of nuance. It's complicated. It's really complicated. Not only Afghanistan, but the way it looks from a woman's point of view. And in this case, it's not necessarily that what women are arguing for is peace. That is not necessarily what they're going to say to you. They don't really want us to up and leave until their government has a real grasp on security. But at the same time, the very people inside of the government who are supposed to have a grasp on security are the very people who were warlords in the 1980s who obliterated Kabul and committed all kinds of war crimes. So it's really hard to imagine how that government and these partners we have in Afghanistan are ever going to be able to give the Afghan people the security that they need.
My guest is Abigail Disney, one of the creators and executive producers of the five-part PBS series. If you're just joining us, the name of the series is Women, War, and Peace on WOSU-TV. If you have a question or comment for Abigail, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Don't wait until the last minute to call. I know you're listening, but if you want to talk to her, give us a call now, 614-292-8513. In the fourth segment, The War We Are Living takes place in rural Colombia, a mountainous region, and there's an incredible paramilitary threat hanging over their, over their necks constantly.
Yes. Constantly. Yeah, these women are really interesting. I mean, it's first of all a big surprise to most people when they watch the film that there are these Afro-Colombian populations that are quite large, actually. You know, so Colombia had its history with slavery, like everybody else in the Western Hemisphere, And then when the slaves were freed, in many cases, they were, you know, driven out of the cities and towns that they'd lived in and driven to the least desirable land. So they are a lot like the indigenous people in Latin America. They have always been frowned upon. They never had social opportunities or education, and they've lived out in rural areas. And so as a result of that, they're always suspected of being aligned with the guerrillas, and, you know, which really was a lot of the human rights violations that occurred in the 80s and 90s in the war in Colombia. It also happens that because they're living on what was 100 years ago the least desirable land, it's very often the places where the resources are. And so they're being terrorized by paramilitaries. It's really unclear whether they're acting as proxies for the government. And this is the slippery thing about Colombia is, you know, there are a million cases you can point to where senators and congressmen and even presidents have been colluding with paramilitaries to terrorize civilian populations. But it's difficult to prove in the now. But it happens that all the threats that they get happen to align with what the government is looking for, which is for them to be pushed off the land they're on so that a big international company can come in and pull the gold out of the mountain that they're living on. So they're fighting through the court system in Colombia, and by putting their foot down and basically saying, literally, it is over my dead body that you'll get us out of this land. And it's pretty terrifying. I mean, to get that drip, drip, drip of almost constant death threats is pretty terrifying. I mean, it's a different kind of terror than the active live fire, but it still feels like war because the terror is constant.
Where does their power come from, whether it's Liberia or Colombia? Where does their power come from to pull off some of these really daring escapades, you know, barring them from leaving the room when they're supposed to be making peace in Liberia and then in Colombia, actually going to court? I mean, that's like in your face.
Yeah, and I think that they always walk right up to that line and very often over it. And there are many stories of women's movements where the women are killed and shot, you know, often before we ever get a chance to know who they are. And I suspect that's probably more often than not. So this is an extremely dangerous proposition. You know, there's a guy in the U.S. State Department, Don Steinberg, who says that arguably is the most dangerous profession on earth. And I think he's probably right. But what they're counting on is this way in which even the worst of us have a little grain of something in them that won't go past a certain line. You know, and so there's always a Charles Taylor, you know, in the mix, a kind of, you know, Hitler-like figure who's a sociopath and he's totally self-motivated and willing to do anything. So there's always that guy. But he's kind of the exception. Almost everybody else can still be reached, still has a baseline. And mowing down a line of mothers who are praying and fasting and singing is, for most people, the line they won't cross. And that's what the Colombian women are relying on. In many cases, that's what the Afghan women and the Bosnian women are relying on, which is this kind of way in which they represent, you know, just how far we've come, how low we've sunk, as a way of kind of waking everybody up.
We have an email from Carolina. She writes, I am a professor of classics at OSU and wanted to say that although I agree with your guest's depictions of war, guess that depictions of war are predominantly focused on men, I want to say that there are a few very interesting ancient works where war has been approached through the eyes of women. These were written by males, of course, so it is the more striking even. For instance, Euripides' tragedy, Trojan Women, focuses on the widow and orphan women left at Troy. And the other one that comes to mind is the comedy Lysistrata, also a classic, where women show how fed up they are with the long ongoing war and they go on a sex strike. Women are stronger by the means that they can use, and they are extremely smart and in charge of their own interests, which differ from those of their war-prompt men. And, of course, Lysistrata is brought up in the Liberian episode.
Right, exactly, because the Liberian women do have a sex strike, and it is rather effective. and the Trojan women, of course, that's really important. They're always in that war narrative, the widows, the mothers, the wife left at home. And, of course, the other woman that's always in the war narrative is the hooker. Or the prostitute. The word hooker comes from a Civil War general who always had a group of women following along behind as a reward to his men, and they were called hooker's girls. So that's where they're always seen. One of my favorite classical female characters in the war narrative actually is Cassandra, who in the Iliad, she's a prophetess. She can see the future, and she's been punished by Apollo her punishment is that she can see the future, but no one will ever listen to her. And all I can think about when I watch the film about Afghanistan is Cassandra, because for 10 years, those women have been saying, you can't put Burhanuddin Rabbani in the parliament. You cannot have these corrupt people. The warlords will only bring us more war. You have to address the threat of the Taliban. They have been Cassandra for 10 years, and no one has listened to them. Cassandra, of all the female characters that are like ours, feels like one I can really understand and relate to and see all over every film that we have.
The president in Liberia, a female, I noticed, I think it was her inaugural speech, or at least some point soon after she was elected, she didn't give that line, hey, I just happen to be a woman who was elected president. She very much gave a lot of credit to women and embraced women in Liberia for what they achieved. And I was wondering, does it make any difference that there's people like, say, a Hillary Clinton out there? Does it make a difference to the women in Afghanistan, for instance, that someone like Hillary Clinton is out there? Is it just the same old with the women in the upper echelons of power in this world?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. Secretary Clinton is very committed to the idea that you can't build peace without women. And so she's really been in there fighting for this point of view and not always winning. You know, her point of view is not necessarily going to prevail in the State Department. It's not necessarily going to prevail in the Obama administration. So she's a powerful advocate, but, you know, in fact, she's one advocate and she's one voice among many and not necessarily the prevailing voice. The problem with assuming that electing a woman president solves the problem is that you can't rely on the one figure to be, you know, the active advocate that you're hoping for. What we need is women in critical mass. You know, we have 17% women in the U.S. legislature. I mean, that is so pathetic. We're being beaten by Afghanistan and Libya, and, you know, we're something, I can't remember the number, like 63rd in the world.
Seems like newer the democracy, the more parity.
Well, I think there's a certain kind of leapfrog quality to the democracies that emerge lately that kind of aren't wedded to old political systems, and so they don't have they have relatively new structures, and it's easier for women to move up in them. But what is that everywhere in the world.
Abigail, I'm sorry, we just lost you again.
I'm really frustrated with this phone. I apologize.
No, that's okay.
Am I here?
Yeah, you're here for right now. TikTok.
Well, and that's all we have. Yeah. But in legislatures around the world, when you get women in 30 to 35%, it's very interesting that these legislatures with critical masses of women tend to deadlock less often, tend to arrive at balanced budgets more quickly, and tend to have less corruption in them. So we've now had enough time with enough of these critical masses of women to see that actually electing a woman to the top office or appointing a woman to the cabinet or two women isn't really the answer. The answer is getting enough women there that they can sort of stop being the lone standout and the signal figure that stands for women everywhere, and they can just sort of like get on with it and bring all of themselves as women to the job.
I was interested to read in preparation for this that the Independent Television Service and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are teaming up for a 3-year 50-film project called Women and Girls Lead. And your series is part of another 3 multi-part series. It's all part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're so excited to be part of this. And we're really kind of the first big series in their series of films. Mm-hmm. Next year, they're going to be bringing Half the Sky, which is based on Nick Kristoff and Cheryl Wu Dunn's book, which I'm really excited about. And then in between, they were getting so much material from not just women filmmakers, but about women and about this question of where do we fit in the image of leadership? What is our future in terms of power in the world? And I really love that PBS and ITBS and CPB, they've all decided that, you know, this is really where the future is. And I firmly believe this is true, is in answering this question of how are we going to go forward in a different way, paradigmatically, if we don't bring women into the centers of leadership. So the ITVS initiative is so exciting. There's going to be tons of very diverse material and really interesting material.
Yeah, among the nonprofit groups aligned with the project, CARE, World Vision, Girl Scouts of the USA, all kinds of stuff. There's going to be community screenings, classroom materials, and that sort of thing. Just there's a very multifaceted approach to this.
Right, and there's an enormous amount of excitement. I think that, you know, this question of is it watchable or am I going to be too depressed is best answered by making an effort to see things in community with each other. And that's one of the things I love about what ITVS is doing, because it's so much more interesting to treat a documentary like a book instead of like just an hour of your life. You know, sit down, watch it, and have lunch the next day with some friends. We've got actually downloadable discussion guides on our websites, and we're going to be live tweeting and live chatting, and we're going to have Skype meetups after the films so that people can talk. For instance, after the Afghan film, we're hoping we're going to be able to do something where women can talk to the Afghan women the next day. So there's all kinds of stuff that you could do that takes this experience of watching and thinking and transforms it into a kind of community of thinking about the way we're going to go forward.
Abigail Disney, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
What a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.